Oh, welcome to Left Out, reality-based radio on WRCT 88.3 FM. Left Out examines the news and presents opinions from a point of view left out of the mainstream media. I'm Bob Harper.
I'm Danny Slater.
And today's program is produced by Matt Toops. Listeners are invited to call us anytime during the program at 412-268-9728, 268-WRCT. Or you can also send electronic mail, which we monitor during the show, by sending mail to bob@leftout.info. Any announcements today, Danny?
Nothing more than the usual. Listen to Democracy Now! Every morning at 8 a.m. on WRCT.
Good. So our first, we have a couple of guests today, but before we go to the guests, we have a few other items that we would like to discuss to bring into start our discussion. One which I think is very topical and timely is the case of Cindy Sheehan, which has been getting some coverage in the news, which is nice. Which is just to remind our listeners, Cindy Sheehan is a woman who is currently staging a protest in Texas. What is the name of
Bush's? Crawford?
Crawford, Texas. Who her son was killed in Iraq sometime during the last 6 or 9 months, and she is insisting on seeing the president to ask him why it is that her son died. And as we know, and as often commented on Left Out and other similarly minded radio programs, whatever the reasons for going to war in Iraq, what we do definitely know is that one thing we do know for sure is we do not know the real reasons, and there are all sorts of stated reasons which are manifest rubbish, and we've been through that many times. And there's certainly been a very systematic attempt to cover up and any serious investigation of what the true reasons for invading Iraq were. So Mrs. Sheehan went down to Crawford along when Bush went on his month-long vacation, one of his many vacations. 20% of his presidency is spent on vacation. That's 20%.
It's a working vacation.
That's 10 weeks per year. I don't know anybody who has 10 weeks of vacation per year, but never mind. Though we are in a state of war, he has plenty of time for vacation. So she's down there in Crawford, Texas, and demanding to see the president, and has been harassed from square one, as you can imagine, because we must maintain the pretense that Shrub has any idea what he's doing, and that he's a fearless patriotic leader. Now, so Mrs. Sheehan is the most recent thing is the New York Times has reported that the Secret Service intends to arrest her on Thursday because she poses a threat to national security. The threat to national security consists of possibly embarrassing the president. And the event on Thursday that's relevant is that Donald Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice are coming to Crawford and may have to actually drive down the road she's on, and there may actually be a camera shot with Mrs. Sheehan in it, and they want to prevent that, so they're going to arrest her. I think we should protest this vigorously. This is a clear attempt to suppress her free speech rights. If there's anything, if the First Amendment means anything, it means being able to do something like this. So I want to play an ad for you from realvoices.org, which is I must warn you, a highly emotional statement from Mrs. Sheehan about her son's death.
His sergeant said, "Sheehan, you don't have to go because my son was a mechanic. He was a Humvee mechanic." And Casey said, "Where my chief goes, I go." And he knew what had to be done. He died in his best friend's arms in Iraq. I imagined it would hurt if one of my kids was killed, but I never thought it would hurt this bad. Especially someone so honest and brave as Casey, my son, when you haven't been honest with us, when you and your advisors rushed us into this war, how do you think we felt when we heard the Senate report that said there was no link between Iraq and 9/11?
This message was paid for by realvoices.org.
So I recommend to our listeners that you look. This is actually a video, but you've heard the audio, obviously.
There's a link on our webpage.
There's a link on our webpage to the site, and you can have a look there. And I just wanted to call our attention to our to our listeners to Bush's callous treatment of this poor woman, who he can't doesn't even have the decency to meet with her, because of course he would have no clue what to say whatsoever.
Well, he's never. I don't think he's met with any of the.
He has met with her previously, about 6 months ago, along with some other families at the same time.
Okay.
They organized an event, and if you look on the website, we have links there. She describes her meeting with Bush, and she says that he didn't even know her. He didn't even know the name of her son who was killed. He acted like it was a party atmosphere and was really rather rude and inappropriate in his behavior. This is completely consistent with stories I've heard from other people who I know personally, or Carnegie Mellon, who have recently met President Bush at the White House, and they were shocked to discover how inappropriate and awkward he was in his behavior. And if you look at Sheehan's account, it's completely consistent with that. Anyway, I would like our listeners to pay close attention to this, because we are dealing here with really a fundamental issue of free speech rights in the U.S. and an issue that really exposes the truth about this administration.
Okay, so the next topic that I want to we talk about is the fact that this is the 60th anniversary of Nagasaki Day, the day that the atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, Japan. There's a myth, a commonly held view, that the dropping of the atomic bombs in Japan was something which accelerated the end of the war and saved lives. It turns out that actually any historical analysis of what was going on proves that that's completely false. That myth is completely false. There was absolutely no strategic reason that it was necessary to bomb Japan with those bombs. There's a speech by a scholar in this whole area called his name is Gar Alperovitz. And we have a short segment of the speech. We only play 6 minutes of it. But if you listen to the whole speech, he develops all the things in great detail. So let's just listen to the beginning of the speech by Gar Alperovitz regarding the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima.
I want to read you something that will give you the latest, what's called literature review summary, in the most recent assessment of the modern historiography on the bombing of Hiroshima. This is from Diplomatic History, a scholarly journal. Careful scholarly treatment of the records and manuscripts opened over the past few years has greatly enhanced our understanding of why the Truman administration used atomic weapons against Japan. Experts continue to disagree on some issues, but critical questions have been answered. The consensus among scholars is that the bomb was not needed to avoid an invasion of Japan. It is clear that alternatives to the bomb existed, and that Truman and his advisors knew it. I want to underscore the last part. It's long been understood by many specialists that the bombing was totally unnecessary, contrary to what you might see in the popular press. But that's an after-fact judgment, after the event. This judgment is that the scholars who are specialists and most knowledgeable say, and Truman and his advisors knew in advance, before using the bomb, that there were other ways to end the war without destroying these two cities. Well, that's a very controversial statement, but I want to underline the source of it. This is not a left-wing politician or a radical revisionist historian or a left socialist scholar saying this. The man who has assessed this does not belong to any of the scholarly camps. He's not a right-wing, left-wing, or middle-wing professor. He is currently the chief historian of the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a very neutral body, and he is telling you in this statement, this is what the scholarly literature, the most recent expert studies, say. It's not necessarily his opinion, it is what he tells you the experts are saying. Now, let me give you a couple more just by way of introduction, just so you get a sense of how others have understood this who've really gone into the documents, and then we can begin to talk about the story. This is something not from recent assessment. This is something from 1946, and I'm going to give you two official 1946 studies of the decision, official government studies. Certainly, remember, the invasion of Japan, had it occurred, would not have been the one that might have cost any serious number of lives, could not have occurred until March or April 1946. The bombs were dropped in August of 1945. 6 to 7 months time before there would have been a real invasion of Japan. There was scheduled a first preliminary landing, not the full invasion, for November 1st, 3 months off. The reason you need to know these dates, I'm going to read you one, the conclusion of one official study from 1946. Certainly prior to 31 December 1945, and in all probability, that's well before an invasion, and in all probability prior to 1 November, Japan would have surrendered, even if the atomic bombs had not been dropped, even if Russia had not entered the war, and even if no invasion had been planned or contemplated. We're going to come back to the question about Russia entering the war. Russia was neutral at this point. That's the conclusion of the United States official strategic bombing survey in June of 1946. One final one. This one was discovered only 5 years ago. A Spanish scholar happened upon this top secret study, misfiled at the National Archives, and brought it to my attention. That's the way historical research works. And he brought it to my attention. No one seems to have noticed it, except the government officials who wrote it and did not make it public. This is 1946. War Department study by the Strategic Plan Policy Group of the Operations Planning Division of the War Department, which is the key operational group that did planning for the military in World War II. Quote, the dropping of the bomb was the pretext seized upon by all leaders, as leaders of Japan, as the reason for ending the war. But the various chain of events, which we're going to talk about, that led up to this make it almost a certainty that the Japanese would have capitulated upon the entry of Russia into the war, which happened on August 8th, 3 months before an invasion, if the first landing, 7 months before an invasion. The Japanese leaders had decided to surrender and were merely looking for a sufficient pretext to convince the army group that Japan had lost the war and must capitulate to the Allies. The entry of Russia into the war would almost certainly have furnished this pretext and would have been sufficient to convince all responsible leaders that surrender was unavoidable. It goes on to say an invasion was only a remote, quote, quote, possibility. So I'm giving you just some of the headlines of the modern scholarship, most recent studies, and the 1946 official, two official studies of the decision. Now, why is that so different from what most Americans were taught and most Americans still believe? For instance, most Americans were taught, most Americans still believe that perhaps 500,000, perhaps a million lives were saved, American lives, and perhaps another million Japanese lives were saved by using the atomic bomb because it ended the war without an invasion. These studies, and I think the modern expert scholarship agree, that that is a myth, a complete myth. And one of the questions we want to come back to is how is it that a myth of that kind could be created and could survive for now almost 50 years?
That was a scholar at the University of Maryland named Gar Alperovich talking about the myth surrounding the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is the Left Out program on WRCT. You can give us a call at 412-268-9728 if you want to talk about this or any other topic of our program today. Let me just make a couple of more comments. I listened to the whole speech. It's an excellent speech, and there's a link to it on our website. I recommend that you listen to it. The whole thing. But one of the key points that he makes later on has to do with the Potsdam Proclamation, which was a demand that Japan surrender by the Allies. And he talks about how that proclamation, originally there was a paragraph saying that the Emperor of Japan would be preserved, would be allowed to stay in after Japan surrendered. They deleted that, which would pretty much make it much harder for Japan to be able to surrender, which was a ridiculous demand because, They left the emperor in place anyway. It was not important at all to the Allies whether the emperor was in place or not. So the insistence or the refusal to allow to put that in the Potsdam Declaration made it harder for Japan to be able to surrender. So all of this stuff led up to the use of the atomic bomb, and it was with full knowledge that it really had nothing to do with Japan at all. It had to do with continuing with the Cold War against Russia and demonstrating the U.S. power and ability to do heinous crimes like this, I guess.